This is 1-2-1 on BCB 106.6 FM.
Hello and welcome to BCB 106.6 FM. You're listening to 1-2-1 with me, Carol Moss. This is the programme where we talk to the movers and the shakers and the active citizens of Bradford, find out a little bit about their lives, their work, their hobbies, their interests, and get them to play some pieces of music. My guest today is somebody who was a public health manager for Bradford Health, working in particular on infant mortality. And Anne Hobbis retired a couple of years ago, but she's here to talk to me about her life, her work, etc. So welcome to the programme, Anne.
Oh, thank you. I'm delighted to be here, but a bit of a pressure to think about being a mover and a shaker.
Don't worry, you don't have to move and shake while you're in here. You can sit and relax and as we chat. Now, your job, public health manager, that is a huge job, but was it specifically related to infant mortality?
Yeah, this was in the last sort of 2 to 3 years of my sort of professional career, my working life, as it were. Because before that, I think, you know, I've been very much involved in food, which I think we might talk about before. But I'd worked, I mean, I'm sure that most people know now that in Bradford they had something called the Infant Mortality Commission. This was way back, probably about, over 10 years ago now. And from that, it was great. There was a lot of, brought in the experts, brought in the evidence, really looked at things quite thoroughly.
Was it particularly because Bradford had a very high level?
It did. It was rising. That was the other thing. Was it was rising, which is really not what you want to see at all. And this was sort of around 2002. I think it peaked. I can't remember now, but I think it probably peaked about 2002, 2003. So, and good on Bradford. I mean, I wasn't there. These were the top people. They said, look, we're not going to try and sweep this under the carpet. We're going to try and address it and see what's going on. What can we do? And so the commission, I mean, was in, it sat for 2 years and brought out a report, and there was a number of recommendations right across the board. And then from that came a job and a post. And I was really pleased to say that in all the changes, that post continued. It has changed now. I think it's much more about child health. But of course, we also got the Born in Bradford study going as well. So people were taking it very seriously.
And have things improved?
Yes. I think, as far as I know, the infant mortality rate has been dropping, steadily. It's still one of the highest in the country, but not, you know, one time we used to vie with, there were some other districts which I won't name, but we used to sort of vie with the bottom place or the top place, whichever way you want to look at it. I don't think we do anymore. I've been a little bit out of touch when you retire, you know.
Retire. And what do you think has made the difference? What do you think that Bradford has introduced which made the difference?
I mean, that's a good question. It's difficult because I think...
probably a whole raft of measures.
It is a whole raft of things. And there was good work around smoking cessation, so you know, that was a good thing to get going. We did an awful lot of work around consanguinity and cousin marriage, and that was new, really, quite sort of groundbreaking stuff. And we were lucky because we got support for that.
Was the infant mortality was it by ethnicity? Did you look at it by ethnicity?
Yeah, we looked at it by ethnicity, and we looked at it by income and socioeconomic distribution, and it was higher, and it is higher within women from Pakistani origin, and it didn't seem to particularly decrease at that time. It wasn't especially decreasing through the generations either, so women who, you know, grew up here in Bradford weren't necessarily enjoying or benefiting from a reduced infant mortality. So, you know, there was something going on that really needed to be addressed. And I think that's the other thing that Born in Bradford, you know, Born in Bradford sort of picked that up as well and have done it in a lot more depth. But I like to think the Infant Mortality Commission did get it started and did identify a lot of the key things to try and work on, which it is really about, well, a lot of it's about young women's health and women's health. But there were different risk factors for different communities, and this is what we were trying to get across as well. So that was it was very interesting.
And you left in 2012, which is now sort of 4 years ago, really. But
I can't believe it's not quite. Yeah, it was.
But a lot happens in then. And as you say, the Born in Bradford. But when you were working on it, were you very much on your own working with it, or was
not
there a team of people?
Absolutely not at all. That was the whole point. We got a strategy. We had, and I think this group still existed. We called ourselves Every Baby Matters. It was the head of the Girlington Children's Centre, who, when we would go around and explain what we were trying to do, and she said, "Oh, it sounds to me as if you're doing an Every Child Matters for babies." So we said yes, and that was it. So we developed the Every Baby Matters, and I think that was like a multidisciplinary. From the council, from the hospitals, obviously the paediatricians were quite involved. Midwifery have been absolutely key in health visiting, plus community groups and public health. We had a good interdisciplinary
And that interdisciplinary group. Team obviously went back into their own areas and sort of implemented things that you were suggesting.
Yes. Well, to be fair, that they will have identified themselves and come up with and said, well, we want to do this. You know, there was no lack of goodwill or enthusiasm to try to do things and to change.
And what about the people that you spoke to, the families that you spoke to?
Families, yeah. Well, throughout the commission there was representation from families. I have to admit, I didn't specially speak to families directly. I tended to be much more sort of back. But we did I think people were really very willing to take it on. And I do very clearly remember this family, this woman coming back. She said, "We go to Pakistan and people are talking about cousin marriage and they're worried. Why aren't we talking about it here in Bradford?" So it was a very mature, you know, these were things which were saying, yes, people want to do it. Why aren't we responding?
Do you think that cousin marriage came at a time when there were fewer people living here?
I don't know. I don't think it helps because you're obviously, you know, there's sort of fewer choices and what have you. But I mean, they came out with this term endogamy, which was really about looking at the biraderies and sort of wider groups and how marriages sort of work within that and how the different disabilities or sort of manifest. And you know, I mean, one of the key messages we had to get across that the majority of babies born to parents who are cousins are absolutely healthy, you know, bonny, fine babies that go on and do really well. But there is a higher risk, and it was like, how do you manage that risk? And how do you look at your own family and your own circumstances and think about it? Well, perhaps this risk is higher for me than other families down the road. It was quite a good message to get to deal with. And I think one of the things we got guided by someone who'd done a lot of work around a sort of sociologist, some anthropology, and they were saying, you know, when you give out this message that cousin marriage is bad, they'll look around and say, but what do you mean? There are so many families around us who we know are cousins and their babies are absolutely fine. It wasn't making intuitive sense to people. So we had to sort of try and unpick it and then really show and really go through the basics of inheritance and then why there was this additional risk.
And I guess all the stuff, the developments on genealogy and genetics and DNA and people on getting to understand how that works, do you think that will help?
Well, we'd like, hopefully, yes. I mean, the more informed. And I think the other thing that people were saying, and certainly Amradar, the social and the sort of social or medical sociologist who helped us, she was saying people struggle how to explain it to people. So we were trying to give the midwives, the doctors, the health professionals tools and diagrams and things to say, actually, it's quite easy to talk about it. You know, you can talk about it with somebody with cystic fibrosis. It's a very similar thing to talk about with somebody who's got one of the other disabilities, but you just, you know, and at the end you just add on, and being married to your cousin will raise this risk of it. It is about recessive inheritance.
And of course we forget that, you know, the British used to do it all the time too. Until they were aware of it. Great, let's start with a piece of music. What's your first choice?
Well, my first choice is it's a very simple love song that I love, and if there's, you know, one thing that's important, it's to get off on a good note. And so this is just The Look of Love by Nina Simone. Nina Simone has been my absolute favourite for years and years and years. Anybody who knows you would know that. So that I just think this is a lovely, simple love song. And if only love was that simple.
The look of love is in your eyes. The look your smile can disguise. The look of love is saying so much more than these words could ever say. And what my heart has heard, well, it takes my breath away. I can hardly wait to hold you, feel my arms around you. How long I have waited just to love you. Now that I have found you, you've got the look of love. It's on your face, the look the time can't erase. Be just the start of so many nights like this. Let's take a lover's vow and then seal it with a kiss. I can hardly wait to hold you, feel my arms around you. How long I have waited just to hold you now.
Look of Love there with Nina Simone, one of my favourites too. Anne Hobbis, you, when you came to Bradford, you came originally, you mentioned that you'd been involved in food and nutrition. What brought you actually to Bradford?
Well, I took a degree. I was a mature student when I eventually got to university. I took a degree in dietetics and nutrition at Leeds, at what was then Leeds Poly, now Leeds Met. And I got a job here at St Luke's. This was one of the places. I liked Yorkshire. Once I got used to the north, and I just loved it. I'm from Birmingham, we'll talk about that. But I didn't want to go back, and I loved Yorkshire. I liked Leeds. And I had been to Bradford a few times, so I came across. And I worked at St Luke's. And to be honest, it was an eye-opener. We, as a dietitian, you sit down, and we are the one group of people that sit down and listen to what people are eating and let people talk about their food, what they're eating and what they're struggling with and what they're trying to do. So you get this fantastic insight. And it was just, this was 1983, you know, it was all in that Thatcherite time. There was a real, again, just like now, there was a real push to reduce benefits and poverty, people were struggling.
Was it the poverty that struck you most about what people were eating?
Yes, I think it's always difficult to attribute things, but there was a real sense that to eat a healthy diet was out of people's pocket. You couldn't do it; it was out of their league, as it were. And it's difficult to know whether that's a psychological, cultural leap to somebody different, or whether it's very real in terms of actually what you're spending your money on and what you're not spending your money on. So I did take this up. I went and joined the Food Policy Research Unit, and you know, after about 3 or 4 years of working in the hospitals, I went and I was lucky. I got the opportunity to go and join the Food Policy Research
Unit. But just going back to that time when you were talking to individuals, now I'm assuming that you were talking to them because there was something about their health.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes,
what were the health risks that took them to talk to you about their diet?
The main one then was diabetes. That was really the bread and butter of our work.
And of course, that still is a massive problem, isn't it?
And heart disease. This was before statins and things like that. So we were really. It was really diet was the key factor. It was important, and we were talking to a lot of people with heart disease and a lot of people with diabetes, and all the things around high blood pressure. Plus, Bradford, even then with children, was known for these metabolic disorders. Well, that's slightly different because I don't think that was much related to poverty. But there's a fantastic wealth of expertise here in Bradford that I think outside the city people don't realise, because people have developed skills and resources and working with people in very difficult circumstances. I've always thought Bradford's got rather a lot of hidden talent.
As well we know
as
here,
because
we try and bring them
BCB's
out.
BCB's one of them.
But the, you say it's got sort of, you know, a lot hidden. I mean, diabetes is still a massive problem. Bradford was identified as being one of those places where diabetes was a little bit out of control. And is there still that
you
work?
You make it sound as if we're completely failed. Sometimes I look at my colleagues and say,
no, not really.
We completely, particularly into the obesity, in the children's obesity, you sort of think, oh, gosh. But yes.
No, just a concern, really, that the lessons of the things that, like, you were doing in the food and nutrition, and especially in the policy unit, I'm just wondering whether they have been fed back and, you know, whether there's that sort of benefit, that we're reaping the benefits of it.
Well, I think when I first came, there was we were 2.5 people at St. Luke's full time, and I can't remember. I think that there were that many more similar at BRI. Now you'll find there's a department of about 40 people working. So I think people recognise diet as very, very important in terms of both preventive strategies, plus the therapeutic side of it. I do think people are much more aware of diet and that you've got to eat well and eat healthy. And of course, the 5-a-day message came in. We were quite heavily involved with that. Now, I have had to live down the fact that I was involved in 5-a-day, because I always thought it was a great message, very simple, great thing, fruit and veg, so simple, let's do it. And of course, everybody teased me about it forever, you know. Oh, yes, 5-a-day, well, here are my 5 chocolates, and 5 this. They were, you know, I really had to live that down. But I would still say that actually it was probably one of the most important diet and health campaigns that there has been for a long time.
OK, let's have another piece of music. What's your second choice?
My second choice is, sticking with the theme of love, this is a beautiful duet from Porgy and Bess, and it's Bess, Who Is My Woman Now. And it's so sad. This could make me cry, you know. This could just sit and make me cry, because we all know that it doesn't work out. But let's listen to it anyway.
OK, I'll get the tissues out. Yes, You Is My Woman there from Porgy and Bess. So, Anne Hobbis, we were talking about your work in nutrition, and I'm always fascinated about, you know, what people do and how people change, really, and how attitudes change. But after your work at St Luke's, you said you went to the university. What was that specifically to do?
Well, I was very, very fortunate. Because I got a grant to do research into food poverty. This is, you know, this had really struck me when we were talking to people how hard it was for people to put the advice we were giving into action. And I wanted to look at it in much more depth. And I did a PhD. It was around government policy and income support and diet, really. And I went out and I interviewed a lot of people, and I asked people to keep food diaries of what they were eating, and it was good. I think it probably what it highlighted more was how difficult it is to actually prove or to disprove anything, and people were eating in very different ways. And to be honest, there were some people who could manage it very well because they were of a mind to do, you know, they would focus in, and they were of a mind that they were going to eat well. And perhaps other things weren't quite so important. But of course, most people's lives are much more messier than that. And it was almost as if people were saying, well, look, 10% of the population eat very well. And this was in national statistics as well. People on income support or living in poverty, there's a group and they eat very well and very healthily. So if they can, why can't everybody? But, you know, life isn't like that, is it?
Well, I suppose it's people, a lot of people, of course, you don't have... although they're reintroducing domestic science and cooking, and that's all become that. You know, flavour of the month, as it were, without wanting to pun. But you know, that message about it is important, what you put in your mouth is still key, isn't it?
It's still absolutely key.
And you were working at food policy, was it sort of food policy at local level, at national level?
It was very much at national level. I mean, this was with Verna Wheelock and Steve Fallows. Verna was really quite innovative, and he would bring the industry. His great thing was that it was a food chain from producer, from the farmer. He had a background in farming in Ireland, and he really knew the food chain. And it would go, you know, right through. This was his big thing, and he wrote a small book about it. It was absolutely fantastic. It was right from the producer, the farmers, right through to the supermarket. You know, we had the sort of big four. In the back in the 80s, there were the big four or five supermarkets that were always competing with each other. This was before Aldi and Lidl and other things that came into play. So it was right from the primary producer through to the different manufacturing stages, through to the retailer, and then there would be the health. And he said, you know, everybody's got to change. If you want to change the nation's diet, you've got to change it right from the start.
I guess he'd be right in there now with the sugar debate that we're having at the moment.
Yes, he would. I'm absolutely certain he would. And I think he would. You couldn't say. But the thing about Verna was he would not take a line. So some people used to get very angry and frustrated with him. He would not take a line, and he wouldn't be either left. You know, he wasn't going to be pigeonholed as left wing or right wing or radical or whatever. He would say what works. Let's see what works. And I think that was a good. He was, you know, quite a good sort of. Not exactly a mentor, but, you know, quite a good, you know, I always took that message from him. You look at things case by case and we think what's going to work here, what's not going to work.
And so I know you can't generalise having just said that, but, you know, for people in Bradford who are struggling at the moment and we've got, you know, you go to food banks and you get tins of stuff and it's not the fresh foods that you would want. What would a message be, do you think, that would... Yeah. To those sort of people, I know it's a hard one to do.
A bit on the spot. Well, let me just say, I think one of the big things that we started to do after doing the research and everything, back working, trying to get things changed on the ground, was set up a food network, and we tried to bring various different people together. What it turned out to be was really a network of community workers, and I think they were identifying all the needs around food skills. And we linked with BSEP, were huge in this, plus the community dietitians, plus all sorts of people.
BSEP was the
Bradford Community Environment Project. So there were some really good workers with there. So we set, and they set up food co-ops and cook and eat sessions. And we sort of had this vision at one time, we had this vision that people would come in with their Healthy Start vouchers. They could exchange those for fresh fruit and veg, and then if they didn't know how to cook them, they could go to Cook and Eat and learn how to cook. Very simple, but actually really quite hard. But some, I mean, I don't know now because I'm out of touch, but I know at one time a lot of the children's centres were getting involved. They were taking this up as a good activity to do. A lot of the community centres liked it. So a lot of training going on around that. And I still think that what we would say, it's really very simple. You know, try to eat five a day, eat a good variety, try not to eat too much, do exercise. Now, exercise just has to be walk, you know, even if it's just walking, whatever, and get a good night's sleep.
Walking is one of the things I know you like doing.
I love walking, yes.
Okay, let's have another piece of music. What's next?
Well, that brings us on. This is Capa Cayley. This is from their LP, To the Moon. Capa Cayley, this wonderful Scottish group, and the singer, Karen Matheson, just has a wonderful voice. And they've come down, they play at Saltaire. I think they've played Bradford quite a few times, so they're known here. And this one's called The Crooked Mountain, really partly because of my love of mountaineering.
Pessimistic. In a square at the edge of town was my fortune laid to bare. She said, climb that rocky mountain when the sun will rise to kiss you, and your dreams will flow like a virgin's brew to the foot of the crooked hill. Feels good to be dreaming. Feels good to be here with you. Wait now. Like a fool, I took to the woman's words, being a slave of the optimistic. I left my friends of childhood and the ones who saw me right. Funny you don't see the sunset and you wonder why you missed it. For a year I saw the skies change till all the days and night. Ooh, feels good to be free.
Capa Cayley there with
Crooked Mountain.
Super Crooked Mountain. Lost my headphones. And so, Anne, well, you're listening to BCB 106.6 FM. This is One to One with me, Carol Moss, and Anne Hobbis, who was public health manager at Bradford Health. Now, you retired a few years ago through ill health.
Yes.
Was that grow? It's something that had been coming for a long time.
Yeah, back in 1995, I had my first diagnosis of breast cancer. And I had the lumpectomy and the radiotherapy and the chemotherapy then. I was off work for 5-6 months or whatever. But I went back and I was absolutely fine for 15 years. In fact, I wouldn't even identify as being somebody with cancer. I used to forget about it. And then in about 2009, I just felt another lump. And, and it took a while. Various things happened. But eventually I had to have a mastectomy. And then they said, yes, it's spread. Spread a bit regionally, but it wasn't. Again, I mean, I was very hopeful to begin with, but what I hadn't properly appreciated was how, when cancer's returned, it is a little bit more serious, really. And it wasn't going to be the 6 months off work and then it'll get back to normal again. It was going to be much more longer term. And in fact, so for 2 years I went on. I didn't have radiotherapy or chemotherapy. Oh, I think I did. I did have some radiotherapy, eventually. But I was on the hormone blockers. And they sort of listed the number of drugs, but it clearly broke through the drugs. And I said to myself, when we exhaust this drug, you can have you go on one drug, and if once the cancer break, I call it, it breaks through that drug, it ceases to work. You don't get put on it again. So you're sort of using up your cards, using up your options. And I said to myself, well, once I get off this, I was on letrozole, I was on it for 2 years. And then they said, well, we need to change now and try something new. And I began to think, I think I should think about retiring. And they were muttering, they were saying, are you working or are you, what are you going to do? So I mean, it came at a time when public health, when there was the big reorganisation, public health was due to move into the council. So it sort of fell into place quite well. But I was so pleased that I did go back to work for 2 years, because I knew I hadn't finished. Once I'd got this diagnosis as well, I knew that there was still work I wanted to do. There were things I wanted to see through. We barely got started on stuff. So, and the NHS were fantastic. I mean, my line manager, Shirley Briley, was great. And you couldn't complain at all. And I mean, this is what sort of makes me quite sad, I think, is that when, the more things get privatised, the more working conditions. We're really going to look back and say, gosh, we had, we've lost a lot, because for me, I thought the working conditions were fantastic. And I was given 6 months off, and I think when it was time to go back, I hadn't finished my radiotherapy. And they said, no, we want you to finish your treatment. Take more time off.
And so what's your situation now?
So my situation now is that, it's a sort of slight mixed picture. I've been on, I've been on chemotherapies. I've had more radiotherapy. I had major surgery 3 years ago when I had my sternum removed, and so I know I have these two metal bars, titanium bars across the front. But this cancer stayed. It stayed regionally, but it's never spread anywhere that's going to cause an awful lot of concern or damage. But so it makes it difficult to know how. I think it makes it quite hard to know how to treat it. Whether to put me through the chemotherapies and the radiotherapies. When really I walk in, they say, well, you walk in so well, we don't like to put you on the treatments. But then if we don't put you on the treatments, what's going to happen? At the moment, I'm on a break. I'm having a break from treatment. I'm pleased. But it is, yeah. I mean, it's, the further you go down, it is I've been told it's a one-way street. It will be terminal, but nobody knows when.
It's a bit like life, really. Life is terminal.
It is. But you always live with that uncertainty, I think. It is different as well. Yeah.
And does it stop you doing stuff? Does it stop you walking?
It is beginning to, yes. I haven't. Well, I was out walking in the Scottish Hills last Easter, and there was snow, and it was just great. I haven't done any since. I haven't contemplated this. I am stopping doing things because I get. I think what's happening, it's getting into the pectoral muscles in the shoulder, and I get dreadful pain. So I don't even want to carry a rucksack, really. And I used to cycle masses. I loved cycling. Well, I went out cycling in September, and I was so pleased. It's like going home. Here I was in Yorkshire cycling in the sun, and within hours I was in absolute agony from. Presumably it was just from the vibration. I'm definitely cutting back. And I'm not doing things, but other things are opening up. You have to be very strong mentally to say, right, okay, I have to let go of that, But let's see what there is, and we can come on to that.
Yeah. Okay. Let's have another piece of music. What's next?
This is a great song. This is a great piece of music, not a song at all. It's just music to get up and dance to. And I think if we were on a desert, I know this isn't really desert island discs or whatever, but you'd need sometimes in the morning, put this on, have a good dance.
Solo Murcia there by Mamboramba. Now tell us, you have a love of Latin. You've been to, I know you've travelled to Cuba. Where did that come from? How did you get?
Well, this came. I can't remember. I think it was way back in 2000, and I think there was a sense then if we didn't go to Cuba, when you know it was all going to change. Even then, we were thinking it was going to change. So I was with my partner Sue. And we took our bikes and we went off and we had three cycling holidays there, which we absolutely loved. I really loved them. And the more that we cycled around, the more that we met people, the more we thought there's something more to get to know here. But that's how it started. It was going and having holidays and doing independent, being independent. And it was great. So that sort of combined this love of cycling and cycle touring with finding out new countries to begin with, I hardly spoke any Spanish, so it really sort of inspired me to try and learn Spanish to be able to hold conversations.
Great.
It's great.
Okay. Yeah. Let's go back to early days, because you grew up in Birmingham.
Yes,
I did. Tell us about the school that you went to.
Well, I grew up in Leafy Edgbaston, and I attended Edgbaston High School, which now so many people might recognise is where Malala Yousafzai attends, and she has made it very clear. She said, she's absolutely appalled at how some of the girls at the school really throw away their education or don't take it seriously. And I am almost ashamed to say I would have been one of those 40, 50 years ago. I found it very hard. It is a private school. It's an independent school. And I found this sort of elitism very hard to come to terms with and never properly came to terms with it. And I ended up leaving really at the age of 14. I almost probably cut off my nose to spite my face with it, because this is how you, I suppose it was sort of inarticulate way of saying this ain't right. And I went and did O-levels down at the local FE college, in fact. That's what I did. But I didn't get that many. Whether I'd have got more if I'd stayed on, I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting one because, probably partly because of Malala, but also I've now talked to lots of people about what they studied when they were at school. And one of the things that we studied very well in primary school, last years of primary school, was about the slave trade. And we did it through stories, we did it through novels, we did it through geography, we did it history. And I can really, really remember sort of identifying with it all and sort of just thinking how awful it was. So I was quite really surprised to find other people saying, no, we never learned about it. Now, I'm not sure how representative that is at all. And the other thing that they did was we learned about women like Elizabeth Fry, who was the great social reformers. So I think it was probably quite a progressive education. It was very focused on girls. It was girls of all ability. Didn't have to get the 11 plus to go there. So, I mean, that was the other thing I think that I really appreciated was this mix, that we were in mixed abilities.
And you had a family connection with the school.
Oh, yeah. Well, my dad was an architect, and I think he was probably a very good architect, and he had designed, this was a new build, and he had designed it. And he was, of course, obviously connected with the governor. So I think it was, when I left, it was really quite, a bit of a bombshell for the family.
You said
it wasn't the thing to do.
You said you rebelled, you told me before.
I think it was a sort of rebellion, yes. It was sort of inarticulate rebellion of a teenager, yes.
And you went off on to FE and then off into the world of work?
Absolutely, I went in. In fact, that's where I was thinking about food. I went and did a lot of cooking. People won't believe it now, but at one time I trained to be a cook and I used to cook and had various jobs. And it was one of these jobs I was working shifts and my mother just said, look, why don't you find out what you can do in the afternoon? Go up to the F, go and see if you can do any A levels. And I went and I did A levels at night school, and I had to go back and do O levels at night school. So I once I'd got my mind on it, and once I'd worked and I was working independently, I was fine. And I came to Leeds, I was saying before, I came up to Leeds as a mature student. So you got grants in those days. So I came up on a full grant as a mature student without having to take any. Being supplemented by my parents. So this just suited me fine.
Okay. Let's have another piece of music. What's next?
Okay, now we're on to a concert. This is a CD that we brought back from Cuba. And, I mean, you've been to Cuba and lots of people have. And the music is everywhere and it's really difficult to know what quality it's like or what's going to happen. And I can remember picking this up almost in the airport as we came back through. And it's since been my all-time favourite CD. I like to listen to the whole CD because I think it hangs together, it's arranged so well. But it's a concert which my understanding is sort of like the happening or the event or something. This is a track called Sahara, but the main thing I think to listen to it is the trumpet, which is Roberto Garcia, and he's quite a known, well-known trumpeter from... I think the trumpet is so... muy limpia, as they would say, so clean. And plus, of course, the percussion is great.
Garcia there on a trumpet with Sahara from Acontecer. Now, Anne, you came to Bradford from Leeds. You came to work. What happened when you came to Bradford? What was it like? What drew you here? I mean, I know we came to work.
Well, yeah, primarily I came to work. But then once I was here, you couldn't help but notice the sort of community activism that was going on. And
Also, we're talking about the 80s, aren't we?
Yeah, we're talking about, because I came in 1983. So there were things going on around, there was a lot of stuff about against Combat 18, all the anti-racism stuff that was very big. And I think it was in the Bradford Three, there was the trial of the Bradford Three. And they would write, there were articles in Marxism Today about this, and that they didn't, they stewed using lawyers because they were the bourgeoisie. It was a very different politic to what you would find now. I'd say it was much more left-wing, much more radical in some ways. And I can remember going around Manningham and you'd think, oh, this would be great. It's so multicultural, it's varied, it's different. I can't remember where I lived. Somewhere. Oh, on the top of Barker End Road, I think. So I liked Bradford. I thought it was quite buzzy from a sort of community point of view. And then there was the whole women's scene, so there was women discos. A women's disco every week was just great. That's partly, I think, probably certainly how and where I started my relationships with women. You sort of have a few tentative relationships to begin with, but it did feel, oh yeah, this is more me than trying to have these relationships with the men that I'd had before. Somehow I felt, how can I say? I felt I fitted in better.
You said comfortable with yourself.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. I just felt much more comfortable with myself. I didn't feel as if I had to try and prove anything or to be something or something different that I wasn't. And I had some very important relationships with women here in Bradford. And obviously that within a year or two I'd met Sue, who was my long-term partner of about 15 years.
And was the scene at the time supportive? Because there was a lot of sort of churning up, a lot of politics going on, but also a lot of becoming awareness of the sexuality and bringing it more into politics and everyday life. Well, were you involved in that?
Clause 28. Yeah. Clause 28 was out then. So that politicised a lot of people. And we were involved. I wasn't a big mover or shaker of that scene, but I was sort of part, we were part of it. There was a whole thing around the women's refuges. Now, a lot of the stuff, which is really quite mainstream now, was really being worked on, rape crisis. These were, you'd know that the women were putting in so many hours voluntarily at night, getting these things going and working them through, getting funding. And now, because they were seen as radical feminism then was really off the wall. Of course, it's all much more mainstream now. Which a credit to them, really. But of course, no, they'd never get the credit. But there you go.
All right, let's have another piece of music. What's next?
Now I'm moving on to the next three tracks, really, which are really to do with, which have come to the fore for me since I've been living with cancer. And this is a fantastic song by Raghu Dixit. In fact, he sings, "No man can ever love you like I do." And I think there are a lot of women who might think that about certain women. But I wanted to put it on because this is what friends do. They make you these mixes when you're on chemotherapy or when you're in treatment, and you just get these sort of wonderful little gifts. And this is a couple that live up the road. She's given me the mix, and then her partner cooks for me. When I used to go for chemotherapy, she used to leave food on the back doorstep. It's just wonderful. So.
तारों में चांद
fix it there. No man can ever love you like I do. So, Anne, you were talking about your relationship and being in a relationship with Sue for 15 years.
Yeah.
How did that shift and change?
Well, it's difficult to say. This clearly isn't the time or place to really... I mean, it's not the place to sort of go into it, but it didn't work out at the end. And I think, you know, if we don't look at your life and you think about some of the regrets, one of the regrets that I have, and this is just not a blame or anything like that, but it is a regret that we haven't managed to stay friends afterwards, because I do think that, you know, you see people who have relationships and they continue, and they can sort of be friends. That really is the sign of what would be a very, you know, complete mutual respect for two people, and I would have a tremendous amount of respect for her. So it didn't, and it was partly because when I it was all coming to an end. It was clearly coming to an end. We were going to separate, and one way that I did it, I took it into my own hands and arranged to go to Cuba for 6 months, and I studied Spanish. I was at the university there, and I met a man there, you know, as lots of people do, and he was proved to be one of the nicest men that I could actually ever think of getting to know. And it took me by surprise, but it was so nice to meet someone. It was very good for me, and it was quite nice just to think, actually, this is all right. I like this person. I like him very much. He's a nice guy. And he's given me a lot. It's difficult to say exactly what, but he's sort of given me a lot in terms of sort of getting in touch, you know, this wonderful sense of, well, we've got a house, we've got food on the table, everybody's well. What's the problem? You know, very, very, very grounded. And that, so that friendship really now has continued ever since. And, you know, I hope it continues.
And it sort of says something about the complexity, isn't it, of human relationships and what you choose and what's right for you at any particular time.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, you know, I think people can sort of look at them from a very European perspective, and they usually dismiss that sort of relationship. But, you know, I would always stand by the fact that I got a lot from it.
OK. Your next piece of music, very quickly, is The Fact.
Is The Fast Train.
Fast Train, sorry, I can't read the writing.
Yeah, this is from The Wire. When you're on chemotherapy, when you're off work and all the rest of it, box sets are quite useful. And I got very heavily into The Wire a couple of years ago, 2 or 3 years ago. And I can distinctly remember when this track came out at the end of series 3, I think. And it was about 7:30 on a Saturday morning, and I was crying and crying for it. And I thought, yeah, you've got into this. This is good.
Fast train, and it's going off the rail, and you can't come back again, and you start breaking down in the pouring rain.
Come back to that one in a minute, Anne, but thank you very much for coming towards the end of the programme. So thank you very much for being my guest today on One to One. If listeners have missed the programme, they can go to www.bcbradio.co.uk. Anne, you've talked about living with cancer. Mm. I've talked about having a very sort of rich life, really, and been to South America, and you brought South American music back to Bradford. What are you going to... You mentioned something about things being opened up for you.
Well, I think what I found, certainly in the last year, that, I mean, I was somebody who always trying to get away for the weekend, trying to get to places, try and do something adventurous. That was what life was about. That's what, say, I'm living. I have really appreciated just taking walks around my locality through the woods and seeing, feeling and listening to the seasons change. So this is a wonderful time of year. I go out, I listen to the birds, I try to spot them. I've got a good friend who's a complete expert and so good. And we try to identify them. She helps me try and identify them. So I'm desperately trying to identify the different bird song. It's not just a sort of background noise. So this is my last track. It's about bird song.
Nice, peaceful way of taking it out. Yeah. Thank you very much for being my guest today.
Well, it's a pleasure. No, it's been great. Really great, Carol. Thank you.
That was one of a party of starlings giving his full song from a TV air.